Welcome to the Moss Island Sounds Podcast, Episode 9. I'm Chris Board. We're sponsored this week and every week by Finelli Sound and Lighting, a Utica, New York production company that can help with your live sound and stage lighting needs. This studio was set up by Joe. He probably wants his equipment back at some point, but I'm going to keep pitching his company and hope he bears with me. Joe and I worked together on a show last week that was incredibly complicated. Over 100 sound inputs, hundreds of singers, instrumentalists, tape, and video playback. Joe keeps his cool no matter what's going wrong, and the show was fantastic. Hire Joe. His number is 315-794-0706. It's been 7 weeks since the previous Moss Island podcast, thanks to everyone who asked when it would return. I didn't plan on being off that long. I think we have a few more episodes in season one, then we'll take the summer off. Saturdays will become brewing days until September. I sort of forgot how much I love writing, recording, and editing these podcasts. Now I've written a lot in 7 weeks. One piece is already in the Moss Island Top 10, and others have barely been viewed at all. So I picked out some of my favorites. As always, I hope you enjoy them. Fasten your seatbelts. I got a lot to say. One of the reasons for my extended break was the play I appeared in, God of Carnage. After the show closed, I was depressed, out of sorts. It took a little while to get back to myself. Finally, the character of Alan was gone. He wasn't a healthy guy. He was a slimy lawyer, a glutton, a bully. But he cared for his family, and I understood him. He's not my favorite person, but he was my favorite character to play, and it was probably my best work on stage. After one performance, a friend said, "You were a real bastard," and it hurt. I knew objectively that Alan was unlikable, but he'd been part of me. I knew things about him that my friend hadn't seen. And of course, it was a compliment. My castmates got similar compliments. I was stopped twice in the street by people who'd never been to a show at Players of Utica before, but who were thoroughly entertained by our dysfunctional group and plan to return for more shows. So here's a plug. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest opens next Friday, June 12th. It runs for 2 weekends, playersofutica.org. So while I worked my character out of my system, the world kept turning. Moss kept growing. Riots in Baltimore, presidential candidates pandering, more Cosby accusers. Antonin Scalia mentally composing ways to say, "The founders never intended to allow gay marriage." Social media posts and tweets and shares all insisting, "If only everybody in the world could be just like me, things would be wonderful." And the New York Times wrote a piece about toilet seat bidets. So let's start with bidets. I had a high school teacher who liked to say, "What if your hands get dirty? Do you rub them with paper?" Of course not. You wash them. It's no brainer. I first tried a bidet in Italy, and I bought an electronic bidet toilet seat about 5 years ago. Dozens of guests have come to my house, used my bathroom, and have been intimidated. I've offered to explain how it works, but they want nothing to do with it. Warm water on my bottom. How revolting, they must be thinking. It's wonderful. Here's the problem. Once you start using a bidet, going back to toilet paper is awful. Recently, This American Life, one of my favorite podcasts, told a story about an inner-city program that gives money to violent offenders, helps them establish life maps, and turn things around. The program has an astonishing 80% success rate. That is, 80% of the participants do not commit violent offenses after finishing the program. Crime is down. But of course, people are upset. "Those thugs get money because they committed crimes? Sign me up!" The same people can't believe prisoners are allowed to attend college. This is our what-about-me culture. We want things to be fair, but we don't recognize all of the breaks we've gotten ourselves. We're offended when fast food workers want more money. God forbid a Big Mac costs more or the franchise owner can't get a bigger boat. Why? Because fast food workers should make a lot less than firefighters or whatever. Does raising the minimum wage really devalue everyone else? Some think it does. Get over it. Let's help each other. Nobody's successful in a vacuum. Nobody does it on their own. It benefits the community when everyone does well instead of just a few lucky ones, most of whom think their success was entirely their own doing. As for the Baltimore riots, we need to look at the big picture. It's not true that violence never solved anything. In the society we've built, it's sometimes the only thing that gets attention. I heard a story about families in California whose wells ran dry when an industrial farm drilled a much deeper well. It's not illegal. Those families still have no water and can't afford to move. What recourse do they have? Get the press to report their plight. But the corporation bought some counter-reporting and waited for the outcry to die down, and those families are still fucked. Speaking of counter-reporting, the list of Cosby accusers is over 40 now. Plenty of Bill Cosby's peers have gone on the record and said the accusations are credible. Those who defend him say innocent until proven guilty, which must be enough for ticket buyers who want to hear him make lame jokes about the situation. Presidential campaigning's begun. We are codependent in this process. We say we want positive campaigning, but the polls prove that we want them attacking one another. We say we hate corporate money in politics, but we elect the ones who advertise all over TV. We are conditioned to criticize everyone in office, even if they're achieving what we said we wanted them to. Politicians use that old line, "Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?" And I'd like to hear someone say, "Are we all better off?" And generally speaking, yes, we are. Republican candidates are selling a rollback agenda. Close the borders, cancel universal health care, put the gays back in the closet. They are selling nostalgia. America can be great again, just like it used to be when you were young. You can get your childhood back. And maybe that will work, and in 4 years we'll forget the good stuff and we'll want to throw out a new set of bums. Same as it ever was. A protester was removed from the Supreme Court when he interrupted arguments about the legality of same-sex marriage. He apparently shouted, "If you support gay marriage, you will burn in hell." After the man was gone, Antonin Scalia reportedly said, "That was refreshing." Which might mean, we don't often get excitement like that around here, except it's unlikely Scalia would have said that if the protester had said, "Monsanto made it impossible for me to keep my farm." And if you're wondering, Glenn Beck says he doesn't care one way or the other, but church attendance will decline by half if the Supreme Court of the United States rules in favor of same-sex marriage. Aside from any religious definition, marriage is a contract between two people. Churches have never been forced to marry anyone they don't want to marry. Those who argue about the sacred tradition of one man and one woman might pause and consider how well the tradition is working out. The divorce rate is something around 50%, and I can't think of too many marriages I admire. Of those, probably half are same-sex. Those who argue traditional marriage is better for children aren't supported by research, although there's plenty of research about how divorce hurts kids. Let's make divorce illegal. Then lawyers would decrease by half. Those who say people will soon be marrying hamsters should be reminded that people can't enter into contracts with hamsters. This is what it all boils down to. But we don't like it. Why can't everyone be more like me? Get over it and stop watching Glenn Beck.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule.
Why college should not be free.
American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone.
I've been thinking about President Obama's stated goal of providing a free community college education to all students, as long as they maintain a 2.5 GPA and their family income is under $200,000. Even if this program can be implemented, and there are many hurdles, I don't think it will accomplish what its proponents think it will. My first career was as a theatrical lighting designer. I didn't go to college. I learned by watching, working on shows, and asking a lot of questions. Once, Utica Stanley Theater asked Joseph Rusnak, a theater professor, for his recommendations on improving their in-house lighting setup. Joseph then asked for my input, and that's pretty much what he gave them. I don't fault Joseph for this. I learned a lot from him, too. My point is that we fetishize the concept of college degree. It doesn't equate to ability or even knowledge. When I worked for Munson Williams Proctor Arts Institute as technical director, my title at the time was technical services manager to avoid confusing people who might think I was somehow equal to the other named directors in the organization. I wrote a series of movie reviews that were handed out to patrons. When the college-degree director of performing arts found I'd written the reviews instead of copying something from Roger Ebert or the New York Times, he said, "You have no education in film." I thought the work spoke for itself. I still do. When I lost my job as a computer network engineer, I applied for dozens of positions. Most of the time, my lack of a college degree disqualified me from even scoring an interview, despite my experience and letters of recommendation from customers who'd been happy with my work. When I got interviews, they were short. "We'd like to have someone with your qualifications, but HR would never let us hire you." That's why I decided to finally attend college. I needed that ticket just to get in the door. I mostly paid for college myself. Later years were subsidized by Utica National Insurance and then Lockheed Martin. Paying my own way was highly motivating. Unlike high school, which hadn't come out of my own pocket, I now had incentive to work hard. As a returning student, older, I observed that younger students tended to skip classes, skimp on homework, and advocate early dismissal from class. Those of us paying for it wanted our money's worth. We didn't want to miss anything. When I entered the workforce as a college graduate, my first job was as a computer network support technician. I didn't use anything I'd been taught in college. 100% of the knowledge required came from my own experience and intuition. Even as I moved on to different jobs and changed employers, my degrees were irrelevant, except as a ticket in the door. I was a dual major, BS in Accounting and Information Systems, 4.0 average, MBA in Technology Management, focus on Human Resources Management, 3.73. I mention these in full because I paid a lot and spent a lot of time, and mostly they don't matter at all. My first boss at Lockheed Martin said it takes 6 months to find the bathroom, by which he meant that productivity comes slowly as the job is learned. That's true just about anywhere. Yes, not everywhere. Sometimes college degrees really are necessary, I know. So here's my point. If the current system isn't doing exactly what it purports to, preparing students to perform specific roles in the workforce, it's valuable anyway. I love the process of learning. I benefited from the discipline of taking responsibility for my own education and writing lots of papers. I got more out of it because I had skin in the game, so to speak. Making college free presupposes it's just the knowledge that will do the trick for students. Give them the ability to attain job-related knowledge, they'll be able to find good jobs. One more step towards social economic equality. But if a college degree is really just a ticket in the door, which is borne out in my experience, it's reasonable to assume the ticket might change in the future, just as it has periodically before now. Make college free, and it will become just like a high school education today. Employers will start demanding more advanced degrees just to pass the interview. Also, those who can afford the more prestigious private schools will certainly have the edge in a job market where most people have college degrees. Absent clear differentiating factors, it seems likely employers will prefer brand name degrees. College is a scam. The presumed value of a degree has to be high in order for people to support colleges and keep them in business. Graduates who get jobs are incentivized not to hire non-degree holders, which would retroactively devalue their own investment. If basic college education becomes commoditized, effort will be made to market the value of a better education. We'll end up where we are now before too long. Free college education will not level the playing field, even if students do make an effort. The gigantic machinery we've built around the fiction of the degree won't let it happen. I'd better say it again. BS in Accounting and Information Systems, MBA in Technology Management from an AACSB-accredited business school. I'm just trying to get my $75,000 worth while I still can.
Hail, hail, rock and roll. Deliver me from the days of old. Long live rock and roll. The beat of the drums loud and bold.
Irish Marriage. A couple of weeks ago, Ireland voted to allow same-sex marriage. 62% in favor, with over 60% of eligible voters casting ballots. That's huge, especially when you consider Ireland's reputation for religious observance. Maybe that's what tipped the scales. We're thinking about America. As one woman said, "We're pro-family, so of course we voted in favor of same-sex marriage." I'm sometimes called a cynic. I prefer the term romantic. Romantics whose hearts get broken are often mistaken for cynics. My daughter's used to me saying things like, "There's no such thing as soulmates." She thinks I'm insulting her mother, but I want Sarah to be aware that real life is not anything like a Disney fairy tale. There are industries devoted to fake romance, to the idea of the one. Recently, I asked Susan, "Do you think we'll stay married once Sarah goes to college?" This didn't shock Susan. Marriage confers legal status on a couple, which is convenient in all kinds of ways that have nothing to do with feelings. But for two people to say, "I choose you above all others until death do us part," is ridiculous. It needs to be a daily choice, as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to be with anyone who doesn't actively want to be with me. Just because we made the choice almost 20 years ago doesn't mean we're still feeling it. I see very few marriages I'd like to emulate, which is why I sometimes wonder that same-sex couples aspire to it. Of the marriages I admire, more than half are same-sex couples. Those who object like to cite children. Certainly, that was a popular ploy in Ireland. Children deserve a mother and father. They cite verses from Christian scripture that suggest the sanctity of male-female union. Bullshit. Divorce has been legal in Ireland since 1996, and there's been tepid enthusiasm for making it illegal in the U.S. Of course, divorce lawyers are more sacred than marriage covenants in America. The sanctity of marriage has been trampled by all participants since time immemorial. In selling happily ever after, our society has done a tremendous disservice to the sanctity of marriage and to the potential happiness of couples going back hundreds of years. People who marry several times are derided for not learning their lesson. At the same time, we are inundated with images that suggest true happiness lies with another person in a family setting. Poor Elizabeth Taylor kept trying to achieve that ideal, probably thought the failing was hers. Certainly she was mocked for not learning her lesson, but I think she was just guilty of listening to the crowd. She was trying to do the right thing. I tried to do the right thing. I was seduced as a young man and determined to make it right by marrying the woman. When that didn't work, I felt dutifully guilty and vowed to make it right the next time. I obeyed the rules. I stayed out of bed, even lived with Susan's parents for 2 months after we purchased a house and before we were married. All because the church and society insisted on the sanctity of marriage and played the happily ever after hymn ad nauseam until we bought it. It didn't make anything better. It didn't guarantee our relationship. It actually made things immeasurably harder, which is what I want Sarah to understand. David Letterman retired recently. Media pundits recounted highlights of Dave's career, which included his sex blackmail scandal. In a perfect world, sex and blackmail wouldn't ever be paired together. But the amazing thing about society is that everyone seems to insist on happily ever after, even when they know it doesn't exist. People have affairs, which are their own business. There are always reasons, but the focus is on breaking his or her vows. "Ha-ha!" we exclaim. "Another couple's failed, just like we have, or might want to, except nobody's found out about us yet." Relationships, marriages, partnerships require consenting people who constantly choose to be together. I'm still married because I want to be. It has nothing to do with how God created me or Hallmark's blessing or Disney's expectations. I'm happy for the people of Ireland, who can now be married because they want to be. There's nothing sacred about marriage except what we bring into it, by choice, every day. When Susan asked me if I expected we'd still be married in 3 years, I said, "I hope so."
And I love her so.
Here's to hope.
I wouldn't trade her for gold.
For everyone. Sarah and the Bullies. It started off with a Facebook post, what I thought was a slightly clever offhand bit. I received an email from a church friend today telling me to sign a petition asking Disney not to show a new sitcom by Dan Savage, which is great because it reminded me to recommend Dan Savage's podcast. One of the overnight replies said, "Savage is the consummate bully." Let's back up. From Wikipedia, Dan Savage is an American gay activist, author, media pundit, and journalist. Savage writes the internationally syndicated relationship and sex advice column Savage Love. In 2010, Savage and his husband Terry Miller began the It Gets Better project to help prevent suicide among LGBT youth. He has also worked as a theater director, sometimes credited as Kenan Hollihan. In his writing and public appearances, Savage has clashed with social conservatives on the right and the LGBT establishment on the left. He has been particularly vocal in response to Rick Santorum's views on homosexuality. He has made several controversial public statements in various media, often lambasting people with whom he disagrees. I don't consider Savage a bully, let alone a perfect bully. But it says something about where we are as a society, that a gay activist who was only recently allowed to be legally married in the U.S. is now considered a person who uses strength or power to harm or intimidate those who are weaker. Google Dictionary. This was my first reply in what became an ongoing conversation. I'll grant that Savage has some rough edges, mostly his indiscriminate potty mouth, but I've never thought of him as a bully. I think of bullies as those who press an advantage out of cruelty, like Monsanto suing farmers when the wind blows patented seed onto their adjacent fields. Or a preacher who said all homosexuals will go to hell, along with those who vote for politicians who support same-sex marriage. Allow me to elaborate on that preacher. I'm a cantor at Our Lady of Lourdes Church for the weekly 5 o'clock Last Chance Mass on Sunday afternoons. This is a regional service, attracting people from all over the greater Utica area. Different priests rotate as presiders, which provides to me an interesting cross-section of liturgical theological approach. Shortly after New York State legalized same-sex marriage, we hosted a missionary priest at the 5 o'clock Mass. He used the opportunity to give a quite graphic 30-minute barn-burning sermon about the evils of homosexuality. He said that anybody who supports homosexuals or votes for any politician who supports same-sex marriage was bound for hell. There followed a likewise graphic description of hell. It was essentially religious porn, and I'll bet that nasty little priest sported a raging erection under his robe the entire time. During the sermon, my wife stood up, walked to the front where Sarah was sitting behind the priest, she was an altar server, and led our daughter out of the church. Perhaps 10 other people joined them. Of course, another 10 people gave the homilist a standing ovation when he finished. In retrospect, I should have turned off his microphone. I was polite, civil, as I'd been taught. I wasn't a bully. Don't make a scene. Let's talk about this like adults. But Susan and Sarah haven't been back to church. For them, there's nothing left worth talking about at the Catholic Church, or the Baptist Church, or the Evangelical Church, the Presbyterian Church. The lyrics change, but the song remains the same. I can't blame them. An old Sunday school saw is that a tree should be judged by its fruit. They've seen a lot of rotten fruit in the Christian church. Back to the Facebook thread. Later that day, Sarah weighed in. She's 15 now. What surprised me is that I've never seen more than a single sentence on Facebook from Sarah, let alone a paragraph, let alone a reasoned argument directed at an articulate adult. In part, the term bully is not solely reserved for those who speak against Christianity. You said that Dan Savage has used his platform to belittle and humiliate Christians, but have Christians not used theirs to belittle LGBTQ people? You asked earlier, how should one counsel a young person who finds himself or herself attracted both to Christianity and to same-sex relationships? Why does one need counseling if there's nothing wrong with them? You also said that Dan Savage is out to defend his tribe, his people, the ones he views as needing protection. If you are talking about LGBTQ people, the fact is they do need protection, especially the youth, from people who belittle them. According to the Trevor Project, homosexual and bisexual youth are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual peers, and each time they are victimized, their likelihood of self-harming increases, on average, by 2.5 times. Being told that they need counseling for how they were born is a form of belittling and victimizing, and it is not acceptable. That's a mouthful for Sarah. It's also better writing than you'll find in 90% of all social media. My first reaction was pride. My second internal thought was that she jumped the argument a bit. I know that the original commenter hadn't used counseling to suggest that all LGBTQ people need counseling. For my part, I agonize over what I write, checking, double-checking, then checking in to make sure I'm responding to the issue at hand, that my statements are logical and defensible. But I didn't say anything, reasoning that I didn't want to defeat Sarah's enthusiasm with technicalities. Then a strange thing happened. It churned in my brain overnight, and when I woke up, I realized that Sarah had been right. The comment, how should one counsel a young person who finds himself or herself attracted both to Christianity and to same-sex relationships, can certainly be defended, and it was, as not suggesting that all LGBTQ people need counseling. But it does suggest that counseling is required if they are attracted to Christianity. Surely a heterosexual person attracted to Christianity wouldn't need any counseling. Sarah did something else that was interesting. She jumped 2 steps ahead to a topic that hadn't been brought up, but which is arguably far more important than anything we'd been talking about. To boot, it suggested why Dan Savage might feel strongly enough about the subject to risk being labeled a bully because of his advocacy. Sarah wrote, "The fact is, LGBTQ people do need protection. According to the Trevor Project, homosexual and bisexual youth are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual peers. And each time they are victimized, their likelihood of self-harming increases, on average, by 2.5 times. There I was, concerned Sarah wasn't being polite or strictly logical, and she got to the heart of the matter without waiting to be invited. On a recent Dan Savage podcast, retired Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson advised one caller to prohibit her 10-year-old stepson from attending church with his grandparents, because that church regularly preached against homosexuality. The 10-year-old's older brother had identified as gay, and the younger brother insisted he was going to hell and should repent. Robinson suggested church was not helping the 10-year-old, and might even be planting seeds of self-loathing that would eventually bear rotten fruit. Sarah knows firsthand the evil seeds that churches plant. Dan Savage knows those seeds blossom in religious leaders and politicians who seek to enforce their interpretation of God's law on their constituents. The heart of the matter really does turn out to be life and death. The statistics cited by Sarah are correct and almost certainly understate the crisis. While my Facebook interlocutor and others of his mindset polish their halos and conduct their lives in ways their faith suggests God likes, young people are dying. They are committing suicide because they loathe themselves, because they've been convinced they have no place in society. I've seen nothing that suggests young Christians are killing themselves because of anything Dan Savage says. But young LGBTQ people are certainly dying because of the rhetoric of Christian apologists. Young people are committing suicide because of Christians. Christians who whine because Dan Savage calls them on it, impolitely. Well, now my 15-year-old is calling them on it, too. My first cowardly reaction was, let's all just get along. What a pathetic, unmanly, inhumane response. Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee, Billy Graham, Pope Francis, Jerry Falwell, etc. You are all part of the problem. So am I. So is every Christian who says, I don't make the rules. Of course you do. We can't even agree on what public figures said and meant 50 years ago, let alone 2,000 years. Your faith is what enshrines the Bible as gay-hating. You need to own that. You need to atone for it. Maybe counseling would help. I know a good 15-year-old. Lauren, have you heard what's happening on Earth? Some blogger from Moss Island said that Christians are responsible for gay kids killing themselves.
I guess they might be upset about that. That's harsh.
Well, they're not exactly upset about the gay kids killing themselves part. They're upset because the writer said they're polishing their halos.
Well, there is plenty of that. Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. That one gets overlooked a lot.
But the writer is defending gay people. He seems to think that they can be gay and still follow you if they want to.
I'm getting old. When did I say gay people couldn't follow me?
You didn't say anything about it specifically, but it's in the Old Testament, and Paul wrote about it.
Right. But don't get me started on Paul. He probably wrote that right after he said that women can't teach in church. Anyway, these people who are upset are living up to all the commandments from both Testaments.
Well, not the ones that don't make sense. They know which ones apply and which ones don't.
Okay, well, let him who's without sin be the first to throw a stone.
You know perfectly well that being gay is a worse sin than just about anything else. We talk about this all the time.
Well, some do.
Listen, you have to give your people something here. Can't you smite this Moss Island guy?
You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raka, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell.
Christians aren't murdering anyone except the people who have it coming to them. And they're not angry, they're hurt, because the government isn't standing up for their rights as Christians. I mean, the government is letting gay people get married all the time now, and businesses aren't protected in their free exercise of faith like they used to be. If we're not careful, we're going to have another 13th Amendment on our hands.
Blessed are the people who insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you.
Lord, these people put a lot of money in the collection plate every week. Shouldn't they get something for that?
Besides their tax deduction, you mean? Listen, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners.
And they are calling the sinners.
They just want them to stop sinning before they come to church and put on some nice clothes. Is that too much to ask? Love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. All who draw the sword will die by the sword. And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that. Let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. I can't talk to you when you're like this. You know perfectly well you're taking those verses out of context. What about at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. What about that one, huh?
Right. Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another man, she commits adultery.
Theologians have figured out you didn't really mean it like that. You know, if we get rid of divorce, it will devastate the legal profession. Some of our biggest donors.
I give up. Looks like you got this all figured out. I'm going to check out this guy's blog.
Before you go, we got to talk about the Boy Scouts. Now they're thinking about letting in gay leaders.
Hey, look. Cute cat videos. Signal to Noise. But to the critic to whom art is important, sacred, and ultimately coextensive with life itself, to produce bad art and to condone it, and thereby give rise to further bad art and finally drive out the good, are the two most heinously dangerous sins imaginable. Miss Shepherd is a model, though how with that dubious figure I can't imagine, whose face Bogdanovich found on a teenage magazine cover. Although her face is absolutely right for JC, nothing else is. John Simon. I love the first quote, which nestles in my cantankerous soul. The second one appalls me. Both are from the same person. I read something recently. Essentially, if you want to understand me, read everything I've ever written. I don't know the author, but the phrase and its variants are common. I've read most of what Pauline Kael and Roger Ebert published, also Jonathan Franzen. Restless, irritable minds, worth the effort to understand. I don't yet know John Simon, but I'm working on it. I'm concerned that modern media, shaped as it is by the internet, is destroying our ability to know or be known. Although certainly we know more about one another superficially. A famous athlete reveals herself as transgender and millions spew reactions and react to each other's reactions. Critics write quickly because their employers need clicks to sell ads. We don't like the system, the media. It's the one we asked for. Free. Ad-supported. Going viral is considered a good thing, although most viral content really is the electronic equivalent of the flu. The first of my John Simon quotes wouldn't play in today's internet. Too many multisyllabic words, and it argues a point of view that Roger Ebert's thumb helped destroy. The second one, on the other hand, juicy. A personal attack based on a subjective reaction to something superficial, which touches on one of our big topics— sex, class, race, patriotism. That's gold. That shit could go viral. The first quote is the one that deserves to last. The second's an unfortunate choice that could have been reworded to get the same point across. Sybil Shepherd's limited acting ability hurt her performance in the Last Picture Show. But today's media, all of us, would ignore the first and bat the second around like a kitten toying with a mouse. We'd keep it alive as long as the prey showed signs of resistance or until something more entertaining came along. We wouldn't learn anything about John Simon, though. To be certain, we're talking about stuff that should be talked about, sex, class, race, patriotism, and modern media has helped raise awareness and speed along social change. Those are good things. And maybe there's no way to change our society this quickly without flash fires and the instant furious debate that disappears the second something else comes along. To get back to John Simon, there's a lot more to him than the hateful superficiality in that second quote. There's more to all of us. If anybody's willing to pay attention. Short people got no reason. Short people got no reason. Short people got no reason to live.
The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins. Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl is my current gold standard for psychological thriller. Paula Hawkins' The Girl on the Train, obviously titled to echo its progenitor, doesn't come close to earning the comparison, which hasn't stopped other critics. Hawkins tries to up the ante by using three unreliable narrators, but her time jumps are just lazy construction compared to Flynn's aha revelations. Rachel is an alcoholic, unemployed divorcee. She takes a daily commuter train to disguise her unemployment from her roommate landlord. The train passes Rachel's old neighborhood, where she can not only see her old house where her ex-husband started a family with his mistress, but another house occupied by a young couple to whom Rachel ascribes romantic fantasies. One day, she sees the young woman with another man, and then the young woman goes missing. Yeah, she's gone, girl. Soon, we get that young woman's point of view, as the narrative rewinds a year. Megan is dissatisfied with her idyllic life, which she is certain she doesn't deserve. She becomes a nanny for Rachel's ex, but quits because she can't stand being around the child. A horrible secret is intimated. Soon, there's more Rachel, yawn, then a third voice, Mistress Anna. The voices of these women are barely distinguishable. They all are secretly self-pitying messes, despite how they appear to others. Their observations about life aren't particularly incisive, the way Gillian Flynn and the best novelists are. It's difficult to turn Hawkins' pages, even more difficult to pick up her book when it's been down a while. If Hawkins has crafted three similar female protagonists, her male characters are even more generic. In order to maintain suspense that anyone could have abducted, killed Megan, each man is given motive and character traits that point to violence. At suitable moments, the guys shift into deodorant ad mode, so we'll understand why all women fall for them. And fall they do. The Girl on the Train is an English drawing room farce-come-thriller, where the pairings are illogical but inevitable. The finale is ridiculous and underwhelming, although I was relieved the whole mess was over. Of course, The Girl on the Train is selling like gangbusters and has been optioned as a movie. It reads like a movie treatment already, without any joy of language. And yet it may become a good movie. I'd like to see three creative actresses develop these characters beyond what Hawkins could. The plot needs to be reworked, particularly the dreadful resolution. It's barely recycled from any number of Hollywood shock endings, from Fatal Attraction to Basic Instinct. One internet commenter wondered if Rachel was looking out the rear window of the train. That single comment's more creative and suggestive than Paula Hawkins managed in 300-plus pages. The Girl with All the Gifts by M.R. Carey. I'm not a zombie aficionado. I don't watch The Walking Dead, and I can't make through any of George Romero's movies. I squirm at the classic horror stories, Frankenstein, Dracula, etc. But damn if I didn't love The Girl with All the Gifts. Damn if it didn't bring tears to my eyes. Damn if it's not a beautifully written novel about what it means to be human. Carey doesn't waste time explaining what's going on or when his story takes place. The first half is told mostly from the point of view of Melanie, a 10-year-old girl in school. She spends her life in a cell, transferred to classes by soldiers who are careful not to touch her. We learn that Melanie is a hungry, the novel's version of zombie. The world's been devastated by an epidemic that's turned most of the human race into hungries, creatures that exist to destroy humans. Some humans remain as junkers, scavengers who create a new society of sorts based on Darwinian mob rule. The remnants of the old society live under military rule and bases, where Melanie and other hungry children are studied. Something is up with Melanie and her classmates. They're able to learn. They don't just want to hunt and kill. The novel's title is taken from the Greek myth of Pandora, the original girl with all the gifts. Melanie has a genius-level IQ, despite being infected with a fungus that makes her a zombie by nature. Carey's language is elegant and simple. He makes excellent use of the premise to make the reader question what it is to be human. Melanie's nature is to kill, yet she fights against her nature once it becomes apparent to her, a prerequisite for any human in society and a step beyond several of the story's characters. Melanie is a memorable character, one you will feel for. Her development and growth forms the backbone of the story, which doesn't resolve as you might expect. I was surprised, even as I said of course, while tears rolled down my cheeks. The novel's plot has been described by some critics as slight, but this is a novel of ideas, and too much would distract us from the thinking Carrie wants us to engage in. The language and situations are elegant. I was reminded of Charles Frazier's Cold Mountain. None of the surviving humans are stereotypes, despite being introduced as such. It might not hold together except for Melanie, a brilliant creation, someone we root for yet remain unsure about until the very end. She is unsure of herself. I can't remember when I was this moved by a genre novel. Something firmly rooted in pulp sci-fi, yet transcending that simple label to perhaps enter the realm of allegory or fable. Of course it's going to be a film. My recommendation, long before the screenwriters mess it up, long before your interpretation is co-opted by Hollywood, read this book. Carrie makes no compromises. The story comes full circle to a satisfying and entirely logical conclusion. A rare book that has it all.
I am Sam. Sam, I am.
That Sam I am, that Sam I am. I do not like that Sam I am.
Do you like green eggs and ham?
I do not like them, Sam I am. I do not like green eggs and ham.
Would you like them here or there?
I would not like them here or there. I would not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam I am.
Would you like them in a house? Would you like them with a mouse?
I do not like them in a house. I do not like them with a mouse. I do not like them here or there. I do not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam I am.
Would you eat them in a box? Would you eat them with a fox?
Not in a box. Not with a fox. Not in a house. Not with a mouse. I would not eat them here or there. I would not eat them anywhere. I would not eat green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam I am.
Would you, could you, in a car, eat them, here they are.
I would not, could not, in a car.
You may like them, you will see, you may like them in a tree.
I would not, could not, in a tree, not in a car, you let me be. I do not like them in a box, I do not like them with a fox, I do not like them in a house, I do not like them with a mouse. I do not like them here or there, I do not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham, I do not like them, Sam I am.
A train, a train, a train, a train. Could you, would you on a train?
Not on a train, not on a tree, not in a car, Sam, let me be. I would not, could not in a box. I could not with a fox. I will not eat them with a mouse. I will not eat them in a house. I will not eat them here or there. I will not eat them anywhere. I do not eat green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam, I am.
Say, in the dark, here in the dark. Would you, could you in the dark?
I would not, could not in the dark.
Could you in the rain?
I would not, could not in the rain, not in the dark, not on a train, not in a car, not in a tree. I do not like them, Sam, you see, not in a house, not in a box, not with a mouse, not with a fox. I will not eat them here or there. I do not like them anywhere.
You do not like green eggs and ham?
I do not like them, Sam, I am.
Would you with a goat?
I would not, could not with a goat.
Could you on a boat?
I could not, would not on a boat. I will not with a goat. I will not eat them in the rain. I will not eat them on a train. Not in the dark, not in a tree, not in a car. You let me be. I do not like them in a box. I do not like them with a fox. I will not eat them in a house. I do not like them with a mouse. I do not like them here or there. I do not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham.
You do not like them, so you say. Try them and you may. Try them and you may, I say.
Sam, if you will let me be, I will try them. You will see.
Say,
I like green eggs and ham. I do. I like them, Sam, I am. And I would eat them in a boat, and I would eat them with a goat, and I will eat them in the rain, and in the dark, and on a train, and in a car, and in a tree. They are so good, you see. So I will eat them in a box, and I will eat them with a fox, and I will eat them in a house, and I will eat them with a mouse, and I will eat them here or there, say, I will eat them anywhere. I do so like green eggs and ham. Thank you, Sam, I am.
Mothers. My mother had a collection of Hummel porcelain figurines that she displayed on the fireplace mantel. My brother and I knew not to endanger them. One summer morning, as he and I watched television, an errant breeze blew over a large unframed picture that had been propped up behind her collection. The sound as they shattered on the hearth terrified us. Then Mom came running, crying, screaming. I was 10, my brother 9. She realized pretty quickly we'd had nothing to do with the accident, but her wild grief unnerved us. We avoided her the rest of the day, feeling terrible because we knew the destruction couldn't be reversed. The fact that we hadn't caused it didn't help. Next morning, we found wrapped presents at the feet of our beds. Mine was an illustrated copy of The Hobbit I'd had my eye on for weeks. Mom was good with the gesture you needed when you needed it. When I was in 9th grade, my girlfriend moved to Connecticut. Mom drove me 5 hours to visit her and maintained a discreet distance as my love and I enacted Barry Manilow's Weekend in New England on the beach. Mom made sure I knew how to cook and clean, skills I'm grateful for. When my father was caught embezzling hundreds of thousands of dollars, her world shattered. Soon thereafter, he left and never contributed a cent to household or child support. Years later, she's happily remarried to someone who treats her well and makes her laugh. We can finally talk about those years without bitterness, without the weight of pain or the sting of everything lost and irrecoverable. She made it, and I'm proud of her. My mother's mother was the kindest and most loyal person I've ever known. She used to drive me all over town in her green VW Beetle, the only car she ever owned. I was looking for comic books, and she was patient as we visited store after store. When I was 19, I moved to Utica, and we'd have lunch a few times each week. She loved Kirby's, where she always ordered the same thing and sent her compliments to the kitchen. When I became a runner, she'd microwave a potato for 10 minutes and heat a can of Campbell's Homestyle minestrone soup on her hot plate. She'd read that baked potatoes were the ideal food for athletes. Dessert was a piece of angel food cake, don't you dare refuse. When I told her I was getting a divorce, a conversation I dreaded, she listened, said nothing, then got up, removed a sticker from a Chiquita banana, and placed it over my soon-to-be ex's face in the framed picture on her dresser. No judgment, no further discussion necessary. My father's body was topped by an identical sticker in another picture. My mother's sister used to pack a picnic lunch and take us to Nick's Lake. She's the only person I know who can take a recipe in Cook's Magazine and make it turn out the way it's supposed to. When I started my stage lighting business, she and my uncle took a chance and invested $10,000. No bank was interested in a young man without a college degree. 16 years ago, Susan and I went for a sail with them and found ourselves rolling up and down 6-foot waves. As my uncle puked off one side, I puked off the other, my aunt calmly piloted the boat. Since I started performing again a few years ago, she and my uncle have frequently been in the audience. After one of those, my aunt said, "You play a good jerk." I met Betsy Larson because she was the mother of my girlfriend's best friend. Betsy had a pile of dirt she wanted moved from the front yard to the backyard. That turned into a painting job and a dozen other tasks that stretched over the summer. She'd feed me, and we'd talk. Once I saw a review for the musical Pump Boys and Dinettes, which was playing at Jiva. She called and said, "They have 4 tickets for tonight. We're going." I moved in with the Larsons when Betsy saw me in the grocery store one day, asked how I was, and made up her mind that I'd be going home with her. I lived there for 18 months. She was furious when I quit my job at Abbott's Frozen Custard to write and act in a show at University of Rochester's Black Box Theater. Then she came to the show anyway, wrote a review. She left it on the foot of my bed. Before I asked Susan to marry me, I asked her parents. I called them, set a time to visit, sat on their couch, mouth dry, heart racing, got up to leave, and finally blurted out my intentions. "You got my blessing," said Anna, a tiny tear twinkling in her eye. Bill said, "She doesn't cook or clean, but I'm fine with it." Cooking and cleaning, you'll recall, I could do. Thanks, Mom. Once Anna and I decided to bake a chocolate bourbon pound cake. We didn't realize the recipe was enough to make several cakes. We poured the batter almost to the top of the cake pan, but we reasoned it must not rise much. Wrong. As the batter flowed out of the pan through her oven, we kept placing cookie sheets underneath to catch the spillage. The cake was delicious. I still make the recipe, cut in half. Susan was pregnant once before Sarah. The baby died somewhere between 14 and 18 weeks along, and Susan had to deliver an hours-long ordeal for her. We were fortunate to have another chance. With Sarah, Susan had morning sickness the entire time, and not just in the morning. Sarah arrived a week early. Susan, it might be the only time in her life Sarah's ever been early. I'd gone out for a run, and when I returned, Susan said, "How about today for a baby?" I wasn't ready. I started frantically cleaning the house. Susan's regular doctor, a petite, soft-spoken man with tiny hands, was on vacation. His replacement was a giant, with immense hands.
Hello, we're having a baby today. You should get the drugs.
But we'd been to the classes, and Susan had delivered before. She'd do it naturally.
I wish you'd get the drugs.
She didn't want any. Hours later, when everyone was exhausted and Sarah was being stubborn, facing the wrong way, which caused the hospital staff to keep Susan in bed, not up and moving around like she wanted to be, the despondent doctor moaned,
I told you to get the drugs!
And then Sarah arrived. I'm thankful for these mothers I've known. They've nurtured me, inspired me, cheered for me, and even saved me. I am who I am because of them. These memories, just a few out of hundreds, are dedicated to Sue, Mom, Ruth, Grandma, Pat, Aunt, Betsy, Anna, and Susan, with respect, gratitude, and love. Happy Mother's Day. Find more essays and criticism at mossislandsounds.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter as Moss Island, all one word. Email me at chris.board@mac.com. Thank you for listening. Until next time. The original writing from the Moss Island Sounds podcast is owned by Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds, copyright 2015. Unauthorized use and or duplication of this material without express and written permission from Chris Board is strictly prohibited. Excerpts and links may be used, provided that full and clear credit is given to Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds with appropriate and specific direction to the original content.